They range in size from huge, like the Blakiston's fish owl of Eastern Asia, to the songbird-sized elf owl of Mexico and the Southwest U.S., less than 6 inches tall and weighing less than half a deck of cards. Owls play key roles in their ecosystems. They keep prey populations of rodents and insects in check, which in turn helps promote a healthy balance of the species eaten by those animals. Owls even help control pests like non-native rodents where people live, all without traps or poison. And they lend their music to our nights. By giving these amazing birds their space when they're nesting, preserving habitats where they breed and hunt, and avoiding rodenticides that could poison their prey, we can help ensure a safe future for our world's incredible owls. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio couldn't do it without you. Support KBOO by becoming a member during our Wake Up the Neighborhood Fall Membership Drive, taking place now through September 21st. Your contribution goes towards grassroots community radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give. Thank you.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Good evening. You're listening to Prison Pipeline here on KBOO Community Radio. We're here today with Mitch Hiley. Mitch's personal journey from a reformed skinhead. Mitch's personal journey from a reformed skinhead sentenced to life to finding freedom through the Beyond Us and Them program. His firsthand experience with the criminal justice system and his role in leading Beyond Us and Them reentry programs in Los Angeles provide a unique and inspiring perspective. Mitch, welcome to Prison Pipeline.
Thank you for having me.
Great. And so we're talking to you today because you have a really transformative story to tell about your journey from a reformed skinhead sentenced to life in prison to finding freedom. So that's quite a story. Who were you, Mitch, before you were a skinhead? Like when you were a kid, what were you?
I was a outdoors athletic kid, kind of running around the neighborhood, really kind of everything sports related.
Oh, great. Yeah, you're really into that sports. That's cool. How did you stumble into the ideology of white supremacy?
It really started kind of in juvenile hall where, you know, that's where you kind of start to see the divide in our system in California. Whites aren't housed with blacks or Asians. And in juvenile hall, really, there's not a whole lot of white kids in there. So it becomes really an us versus them mentality.
So it's kind of, it's part of the culture of juvenile corrections in Southern California. That's part of like your experience.
That's the stepping stone for sure, but that's definitely not just juvenile. That is a statewide prison system as well as juvenile system and jail system.
Sure. And how did you end up in juvie?
I stole a car.
Oh, that's a good one. I do. I have to admire I mean, I think that it takes a lot of skill to like be able to do that. Portland is a big center for stolen cars. It's like, I think we get like about 10,000 a year. And I think that the people who have that kind of ingenuity to be able to do that, like, probably can do all sorts of amazing things in life. So
100%. There, a lot of the criminal skills are actually transferable once you kind of get some pro-social skills underneath your belt.
Yeah. So what was it? Tell me about being a skin. I don't know what it's like to be a skinhead. Like, I mean, are there rules? Is there a culture to it? I mean, what's involved in being a skinhead? I assume you have to shave your head.
It's definitely a militant type of lifestyle. It's definitely, so skinheads kind of separate themselves from Peckerwoods or Woods. And what that really represents is a divide, unfortunately, amongst just our own race, really. But unfortunately, I always looked at skinheads as people who were more active or more successful in the criminal lifestyle. And I bought in because, again, no one wanted to be viewed kind of weak, and I didn't want to be viewed as weak. And that was one of my angles, was like, okay, I'll just, you know, join this group and commit violence to show them that I can fit in with them.
Yeah, that's like, I mean, I understand that once you're in the system, especially if you're in for a while, that's a really big part of surviving, is proving that you're tough, proving that you're not a victim, and being able to project power.
And status. So, sure.
And status. So Mitch, tell me what happened to you that got you sentenced to life in prison? How did that happen?
So from 18 to 22, I had been in and out of the prison system, jail system. When I was 18, I actually told the courts, they said I could do a county year or send me to prison. I told them to send me to prison. They were kind of concerned when I said that, but I just looked at prison as like, this is where I need to go to train. This is part of the lifestyle I live. Like, when I'm on the streets, I run around, and when I'm in prison, this is what I do. I just kind of looked at prison as a byproduct of my lifestyle. So I never was the type who was going to call someone to get me out. I didn't do any of that. That was just like, okay, we're doing this now for the next however long. But eventually it progressed to where I was hanging out with skinheads on the street. We were running around, and I committed a home invasion robbery for the benefit of our gang, and ultimately harmed two innocent people, and really kind of changed their path for the rest of their life. So it hasn't been an easy journey kind of facing all that stuff, but I've had to walk through it.
So you committed a robbery, home invasion. And in the process, you harmed two people in a way that is going to affect them for the rest of their life. And so for that, you received a life sentence?
That's correct.
And then where did you do your time?
I've been kind of all over the state, but majority of my time, I spent 8 years in Ironwood. That's actually where I met Jared and the Beyond Us and Them program. But I've been Kern, Delano, up north, Pleasant Valley, just a few places.
All within the California State Penitentiary.
Correct. Yeah.
So when you got your sentence, I mean, how did that feel? Were you, what was that like for you once you received that sentence? What was going on for you?
Excuse me. In all honesty, I was so young that I was kind of just not really processing what actually was happening. And then when he said the time, that's kind of how I felt. But once he said what he said at the end, it really kind of affected me. And he said, good luck to you, you know? And it's like the judge is telling me good luck as a 22-year-old kid going to a level 4 maximum security prison. Like, what kind of system is that? It shouldn't, like, basically he's letting me know, like, hey, it's going to be treacherous. Good luck to you. You know? And I'm like, that's where they failed me. Like, in my opinion, like, there's gotta be something different done where you're not putting a child in these places, to kind of buy into more ideology and get deeper involved in the criminal enterprise.
Were you prepared for what you encountered once you started your sentence?
I mean, I've kind of lived the lifestyle, so I knew what I was kind of up against. But again, the first 4 or 5 years of my prison term, I was still kind of very much that person. So I kind of just did what I needed to do to get by while I was there. But it wasn't until about halfway through the time where I started to kind of look at things differently and potentially look for a potential release date.
So you were you? I guess you weren't sentenced to life without parole. Then you had,
I had a 15 life sentence.
Oh, 15. Okay, so you had an out. Yeah, and as the time came near to where you might be open to being considered a candidate for parole, what was starting to change for you then? I mean, were you thinking about other options in life besides just a life of criminality?
Yeah, and you know, that's kind of where Beyond Us and Them comes in. It really kind of helped me look through a lens differently, especially regarding like what I wanted to do, not just with like my life, but like what career I wanted to do. It, Beyond Us and Them and sitting in those circles really helped me connect and figure out who I was so I could figure out what I want to do, and ultimately brought me doing what I want to do. I want to help those who are formerly incarcerated. I want to help people who are incarcerated, and I want to help those who struggle with substance abuse and mental health. So this is what I do. It's been a privilege to kind of be a student of the process, and now kind of being in a place of allowing or being the gift to give to others to kind of sit in these circles and really find out what's important in life and what's real, as opposed to what's been conditioned or told to you.
So as a former AIC, you have become an expert on what the process is like to be incarcerated. I mean, the pitfalls that lead people to incarceration, the problems with the system that keep people incarcerated, and the things that keep them coming back. Tell me, Mitch, a little bit about how you met up with Jared and the folks at Us and Them. And how did that change your life's trajectory?
So I met Jared, I want to say 2014-ish. They came in and I was kind of on my journey already of self-exploration and trying to figure out, hey, is this something I want to do? Do I want to grow? Do I want to potentially try all this and then change and then be stuck in prison sober and spend the rest of my life here? You know, and then Center for Count or Beyond Us and Them came, and it was really, again, I was very judgmental of the group, and I felt like it wasn't necessarily something I was going to stick around for, but I was further enough in my journey to kind of like just see what it has to offer. But I just remember sitting in that first group, and again, prison is extremely racial, and we're sitting in a group of Hispanics, Blacks, Whites, and it was just uncomfortable. And I didn't know like how I was going to feel or express what I was going to say when it was my turn. And I remember a African-American male shared something that really hit me, and it was something that affected my personal journey, like from my childhood. And it was the first time in my life where I had looked at someone, well, I don't, not in my life, but since I had been kind of going down the racial identity path, it was the first time in my life where I saw him for being like an actual human being, not an enemy, not Black, not a threat. It was just some guy sitting across from me that had been through some stuff like at me. And it really kind of, that was what really drew me coming back to the group, because I wanted to learn. Like, I've been taught so many things and I say I believe them, but why do I believe them if I don't even know like who or why I believe them?
How do you think it was for the other guys in the room? I mean, do you think they were just as uncomfortable as you?
Oh, 100%. There's not a single person in that room, including probably Jared and the sponsor. Like, when it's the first time sitting in a circle with a bunch of different races, it's always, you know, there's always kind of an edge on it. And sometimes it works out. Sometimes prisons won't even allow it. It just kind of depends on what the facility is. If it's a more progressive yard and there's not as much violence, they can do more things.
Yeah, it must be kind of, it must have been kind of weird too, going from that and then going back into the culture and then coming back to this and then going back to that again. What was that like?
Well, the first time going in, it was a humbling experience. And I remember, like, we weren't even out of the prison yet. And Jared was like, we were talking about, like, how was it? And I'm like, bro, we're not even out yet. Wait a minute. Like, hold on. Like, because I just didn't know, you know, like, you get to the last gate and you're like, are they going to jam you up? Are they going to say something? So it was overwhelming. And I even told Jared prior to that, I was like, dude, I'll probably never go back inside, you know. But long story short, I've been going in, and to be honest, it's where I go to recharge. Like, when I sit in that circle with those men and I feel their pain, I feel their trauma, I feel their hope. Like, I just want to be a piece of that, you know, puzzle to give them some kind of inspiration to do the things that they need to do when they don't want to do them.
Yeah. Well, tell me a little bit about Beyond Us and Them. What do you guys do? And do you operate up here in Oregon, by the way? That's where we're from.
So we're actually nationwide. We're kind of all over the place. We do a few different things. As far as we don't just train those who are incarcerated. We also work a program called Power, which is actually training law enforcement in the same practices, but it's a little unique for them in the sense of it's geared towards really kind of their culture. So having said that, we've trained LAPD, we're in Jacksonville, and this is all simultaneously why we're working with those who are incarcerated. So the goal is really to kind of get beyond us and them. The system is the system, and that's the actual issue. It's not that it's not the fact that, you know, cops are authority figures or prisoners are bad people. It's like cops have their own issues, the stress, the PTSD, all the demands of the job. They need something to kind of heal from, to be better, to make sure when they are in a high risk situation, they manage it better. And vice versa with someone who's incarcerated, like, we need to prep them and give them a skill set to handle things when life becomes life and things don't go their way. So it's really a cool experience for, you know, two kind of different individuals, but really impacted by the same system, to really just create a connection and healing where people can really, really rehabilitate inside prison.
We're talking today with Mitch Hiley. Mitch is a former skinhead who was sentenced to life in prison in California Correctionals and eventually found freedom in part through the Beyond Us and Them program, which Mitch now works as a program manager for. Mitch, tell me a little bit about Beyond Us and Them. Like what do you guys do? I mean, when you go to a prison, like what does that look like?
So for a training, we actually have 2 8-hour days. So we'll send two trainers to go sit in a group with potentially 20 to 25 individuals. That day is, they go over the literature, or excuse me, the curriculum. They learn what counsel is. They learn about kind of what insight, compassion, and resilience is. And then we kind of get into that circle, and they train themselves in the sense of, like, there is no leader. The circle is about equality. The circle, as the trainers will leave after the two-day training, now the group will run itself. So the goal is really to go places, provide the information, and allow them to kind of create their own safe place with the practice of counsel, you know. And that works also in schools, employment places. We do a lot of different places. We provide circles at a lot of different venues.
And what do you go through the same approach that you kind of went through when you were in it? Like, do you try to bring together people of different races, like from prisons maybe where there's racial segregation? I mean, I know a lot of prisons are, most prisons are segregated by race.
Right.
I mean, is that kind of your underlying goal, is to, like, get people from the different groups together to sit in one room so they can all understand each other?
That's definitely long-term, but the goal right now is to get people to kind of find their own journey, especially those in prison. Because, again, everyone's going to find that time when it's unique when someone feels comfortable enough to let go of like all the old stuff and accept like, hey, I can be friends with someone who doesn't look like me, you know? So that's kind of a tough thing to gauge. But as far as like the group actually builds like a cohort, and then they become like, I was at Ironwood for, like I said, for a long time. I was in that group for 4 years. Every single person that was in that group, there was 25 of us, every single one of them came home. They're all home. One of the first people who are the first person who called me when I got out of prison was the black dude that sat across me in this group. He was the first individual that was like, yo, whatever you need, I got you. That's what, when I realized like, dude, this stuff is real. Like my first call from home is from a black guy. Like it was just a really cool thing. And it's been real inspirational to just see the work. And really like, I can't explain counsel. You just have to sit in it and you'll see like how powerful it is.
So, tell me a little bit about your experience of finishing your sentence. How did that go? Because I didn't get a chance to ask you earlier. I think you said you did 8 years. So how did you eventually leave prison?
I did 11. I eventually left prison with a bill for, it's called SB 261, which is if you were 23 years or younger, you could earn potential time off your sentence as well as go to a board hearing early. So I kind of started to educate myself. I got my AA and my BA in prison, and then I prepped for board. And one of the things that I really did for board was a lot of the counsel practice. Like when I spoke, I wanted to speak from my heart to those commissioners. I wanted them to know like, hey, this is what it was, this is who I was, and this is how I saw the world. And you know, like that was a very hard thing for me to do, as opposed to what I would normally do is like, I don't know what you're talking about, I didn't do it. And 11 years later, still playing the same game. So that's where I really attribute to sitting in those circles and getting comfortable. And again, when your life's on the line and you're sitting in front of two people who have potentially your freedom sitting there, like I was the most comfortable I'd ever been because of the practice of counsel.
Well, congratulations. And how long have you been out now, Mitch?
Almost 5 years. December will be 5 years.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah. And just FYI, like prior to that, like I don't think I was out like 3 months from like 14 on. So it's been really an amazing journey. I have a 1-year-old. My wife, who was with me my whole journey, is still by my side. It's just been really just a real miracle to sit here and be on this station, really.
Well, congratulations. That's great. I mean, are you still friends? Do you still stay friends with any of the people that you were in your original group with when you were still in prison?
Oh yeah, we have a squad. We have a group chat. We follow each other on social media. And it's cool. A bunch of them have kids and they're just doing the family thing, and it's cool. We do birthdays together. It's been a real cool fellowship for sure.
Well, that's great. So let's talk a little bit about Beyond Us and Them. Where does Beyond, I think I saw that you operate in 29 prisons in California, and I guess you mentioned that you're also doing something in Jacksonville, Florida and Vermont. How long has Beyond Us and Them been around? Do you know anything about the history of it?
So Beyond Us and Them has been a few months, but Center for Counsel, I want to say is either 2012 or 2011, somewhere around there.
So it was originally called the Council for Insight, Compassion, and Resilience. It was the Inmate Council Program.
Correct.
Okay, cool. So it started from the outside a little bit, but it sounds like now it's really kind of an insider sort of thing. Folks who've been on the inside and are now out, like, have a big role in it.
That plays a role. We do have a little bit of a reentry program in LA, but I would say on a scale, like a lot, we're doing a whole lot of stuff with law enforcement as well. So that's kind of the two. We do stuff with schools, but right now it's really law enforcement, like you said, and prisons. Like you said, we're in 29 prisons in California.
So you guys also work with the police. I haven't really asked you that much about that part of the program because I've really been focused on your story, Mitch. But How does that work? You know, the police, those are like the guys that arrest you, you know, and when you're in prison, are you also working with folks who work within the prisons, like correctional officers, that sort of thing?
So we're definitely trying. There's a little bit more red tape to kind of work with CDCR than there is, say, law enforcement. So that's kind of been a struggle of ours. But the reality is, a lot of times when we run these groups, I know like sponsors or even Jared have told us that officers have said like, hey, really there should be something like this for us as well, you know? And it's just culturally, it's not acceptable in their culture right now, but hopefully we can get to a place where, you know, like that they realize they're actually going to bond closer as a unit and work better as a team if they become more vulnerable. I mean, some of these guys have seen some crazy things, you know, stabbings, like, you know, like some real things, and then they just go home at night and don't process any of that information. And at what cost, you know, people, like officers after they retire are dying, what, like 5 years after they retire? That's crazy, you know?
Mm-hmm. Is that a lot of the work for both folks who are incarcerated and also for the work with the police is dealing with, like, giving people a chance to sort of talk about their feelings, their experiences, process some of their trauma, and kind of bond?
That's really, it's just, a council is a safe space to share your experience or your story. And there's something that happens when someone gets vulnerable and shares a story that's really deep or painful, that others feel encouraged to kind of join in on that. And that's where healing comes. That's where people express the things they've been through and process. And now they're talking about it. And when officers or prisoners are seeing violence or living violence or have been through violence and don't have that out, officers are taking their life, prisoners are violent, using substances. So it's just really a practice to kind of give the men who want to fish something to fish with.
Sure. Yeah. So it's giving people some really good tools for healthy emotional survival and maybe even for recovery.
For sure.
Yeah, that sounds great. How often do your groups meet, like in the prisons? How often do you guys meet? Like, do you meet like every week? How often do they meet?
So they meet every week for 2 hours. Mm-hmm. Obviously it varies on the prison from what days, but they meet weekly, and really the whole goal is each participant will end up being a facilitator at one point. So one will lead, and then the next week someone else will lead. So that's really trying to empower them to all kind of step up and realize like it's okay to be a leader and it's okay to be a participant.
And once the program gets started, does it run on its own, or do you guys come in from the outside to facilitate it every week?
No, it runs itself, but we do two check-ins throughout the 6 month period to see how it's going. We also provide DVDs and a book for them to kind of pull from if they kind of lack inspiration or struggling with coming up with a new prompt.
Are you guys able to keep in touch, like, you know, electronically or telephonically during the course of the program?
So a lot of that stuff goes to our reentry hub and our reentry program manager. So he'll take those calls. I don't really take calls from those who are incarcerated just because I go into prisons a lot. So it just kind of gets sticky if I'm taking calls from people.
Yeah, sure.
So that's kind of my role. But a lot of my role is interacting with wardens, CRMs, to kind of get approval to come in or to see if it's a prison we even want to work at, stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. That's great. And how long have you been doing this work with Beyond Us and Them, Mitch?
Almost 2 years.
Oh, great. Well, that's wonderful. And how about your personal life? What's happening in your personal life?
Well, I, like I said, I have a one-year-old, so I'm kind of just learning what it's like to be a one-year-old again. it's just, I will say this, counsel has really helped me accept and learn to kind of look through like what's being like present, being present for my kid. And like when he's crying, like I just kind of tell myself like he's crying for the moment, you know? And it's, I utilize a lot of the skills from what I've learned in counsel with being a father. And it's been a blessing for sure.
Well, that's great. That's a really great story. Mitch, if people want to find out more about Beyond Us and Them, if they want to get involved, or get connected? How can they find out about you guys?
So we have a website, beyondsnm.org. You can come check us out. That'll show all of kind of what we do. It'll show our power program. It'll show our CRCR program. Also have some videos. Also, it actually shows my journey of while I was inside and my journey home. It's actually a really good video to check out.
All right, great. Well, Mitch, thanks so much for being on Prison Pipeline, and congratulations on becoming a new father.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be
are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.